www.themouthmagazine.com.
You're listening to The Mouthcast, and I'm absolutely delighted that my guest on this edition is an old friend, an old colleague, in fact, Mr. Matthew Headley Stoppard. Welcome to The Mouthcast.
Thanks for having me.
Find us in the parks, riding swan-shaped pedalos, along the River Styx, running by the rusty playground, where the sunshine bounces off the slides and swing frames are the colour of fire. I'll take no calls today, Diane, you'll find us in the parks. We carry a fistful of breadcrumbs in a King's Mill bag, knotted to our belt loops, setting booby traps for the groundsmen, the dog fowlers, the childminders and their buggies. Cancel my appointments, you'll find us in the parks. I have never seen an owl in the wild or stalked roebuck, but I've held the reins of a whippet-drawn chariot and helped a hedgehog move house. We dodge the terrier turds, we storm the bushes when night falls, flushing out the peeping toms and flashing torches on their arses. Give us the boundaries and give us the signage, the chain link fences, keeping us inside, entire communities under our cardies, breathing in their farts. You'll find us in the parks, among 27 species of bird waving a sick note. Mid-morning, on a weekday, you'll find us in the parks, naked and nettle stings. You'll find us in the parks, yes, you'll find us in the parks, nosebleed and polyacoff. You'll find us in the parks, yes, you'll find us in the parks, cut grass and video plus. You'll find us in the parks, yes, you'll find us in the parks, flannel and tennis ball halves. You'll find us in the parks, yes, you'll find us in the parks.
Matt, poetry is an incredibly important art form that needs to be taught in schools, I feel. But when you were at school, is that where the interest started?
Definitely the poetry. If you have a good teacher, I think that's the cliche, but it's a true one. If you have a good teacher who makes literature come to life, and I've certainly had that in towards the end of school, and at junior school as well, I remember... a poet, I think he's still alive, called Wes McGee, came to the school and he read from his book Morning Break, and that was the first book I ever bought when I was 10 years old, and I still have it, and it's signed and it's dated, so I always sort of refer to that if I ever think that I'm not enjoying poetry, that particularly the poetry I write.
I think he came to my school as well, actually. I've got this really clear memory of him talking about a workshop that he'd done with some children, and he'd asked them to write a poem about trees, a poem about the sea, and a poem about the sun. And he'd been really impressed that an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, I think, had written this poem about the sun that he considered incredibly profound. I'll always remember it. It was "Red Ball, That's All." Fantastic.
Yeah.
So the inspiration from somebody like Wes McGee then, did that inspire you to start writing yourself, or was it more of a, were you more of a reader of poetry, more of a digester of it?
There was a moment, and I remember it distinctly, because I was 15 years old, and it was my birthday, and I don't know why, I just felt a bit like, I don't know, just an empty vessel sort of culturally. And I said, I was with my sister at the time, who's older, and I just said, I want to be interested in more things, just like music and poetry. And she said, you should read Dylan Thomas. And I read Under Milkwood in, you know, an hour, however long it takes to read it. And that was it. That's what made me realise is that's how I was going to process the world from that point on, through poetry, either writing it or reading it. And it was that moment. And I didn't sort of seriously write any poems till about 18, because it was just a personal thing then. And when you meet other people, other poets, it sort of opens the world up to you. And then you've sort of got the anxieties of submitting them to competitions or trying to get a book published or trying to get a gig or something like that.
It's interesting that you touched on just then the idea that poetry can be quite a private thing. Because I often think that people stand outside of it, if you like, and almost view poetry as like the Masons or something, this kind of secret, impenetrable thing. Is that how you felt about it at that time? Is it something that you...
Yeah, I think it can be elitist in lots of different ways, I guess, even intellectually. Like sometimes I'll be employed to run workshops, and I know people just will, you know, the thought of bearing a memory or a feeling about something just horrifies them. One lady who's a pensioner said, I would rather take all my clothes off and run around the room than write a poem about something personal that happened in my life.
Okay.
But I think that sort of compounds what you said, because if you feel you're not part of the club, or if you write poetry for private reasons and you see people sort of making money off it or whatever, again, it separates people, and which is a shame, because that's not what I'm about. That's why I like to read in public, because I like to see other poets. And I think Ted Hughes said there's nothing better, there's no truer moment than the poet reading their own poetry.
And the actual art form of poetry itself, it can be quite impenetrable, I think. Or people feel that it can. So, but I would guess, because your poetry is easy on the ear and accessible, and I mean that in the best possible way, it's not impenetrable, it's understandable and it's relatable. But I think people have this idea that it's not going to be, so it's kind of ignored.
Yeah. I mean, people might just not want to read it, especially mine, lately. I can see why you wouldn't want to sit down and read a collection of poetry on, I don't know, World War One, when you could read Barbara Taylor Bradford, or, you know, you could read a novel that sort of has some grounding in your world, or it has some fantasy element that you want to be with. When, like, why would you have to mathematically solve a problem like poetry to enjoy it? So I can see where people are coming from in that respect. But I think the readings allow people time, the audience time, to get to know a poem through the poet, which is only a good thing.
As I mentioned a moment ago, your poetry is accessible. I found it really, really funny at times, really arch at times, which I really like. But I don't feel like it's laughing at the listener in any way whatsoever, or the reader in any way whatsoever. You actually recorded some stuff with Adult Teeth Recordings, for Adult Teeth Recordings, and those recordings are quite sort of reminiscent of what John Cooper Clarke did, actually, around Snap, Crackle, Bop, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Was that the intention? Was there a bit of homage there? Because the music that the Glass Delusion came up for your poetry there, was off the wall. Very, very strange.
Yeah. Yeah, there were, for the album, which I think has got 10 songs on it, or 9 songs, but seven poems already existed, and I wrote 2 new ones for the album specifically. But Lewis had, he wrote those and then sent them to me, and then I sort of saw which ones would fit. But I, because I know Lewis and we've both got sort of a surreal sense of humour, that I thought it would work well anyway. And we liked, John Cooper Clarke was definitely your reference point, but also The Fall was definitely like a major influence on what we wanted to achieve. Although I don't sound anything like Mark E. Smith, that it would be good if I did. But I don't.
And you don't look like him.
Either. No. That's... I've got a tank top that would look like a Mark E. Smith tank top. And for me, and I didn't really tell this, Lewis, there's a poet, you'd probably call a modernist poet, Edith Sitwell. She wrote a piece of poetry with music called Facade, and she read it through like a long trumpet with a wall in front of her, and it's just sort of this wild, definitely of its time poem, and she's quite plummy when she speaks, so that must have been something to watch. So, but for me, that's what I wanted to achieve, something like that.
So it was a statement in a way. Is it art or is it poetry there? It's...
I wouldn't give myself that much credit that I was clever enough to say this is going to be a statement, but it was just trying to make something good, which is very profound. But, just the challenge of taking what Lewis had done on some songs and maybe speeding up parts of the poem as I read it, and having breaks to make it, dramatic's like a heavy word, but so that there is some, so we created this world, if you will. Like the album's called Runt County, and the way I imagined it was that we were creating this little microcosm, like Twin Peaks or something, where something's always happening and there's different characters.
Because it'd be quite easy to just slap a poem on top of some music, wouldn't it? And know, I think what I'm trying to say is that the music kind of coloured in the bits that the poems, didn't need to refer to because the music was there. They had supported each other really well, I think.
Yeah, and they didn't really marry up all the time. And that was on purpose, because if you mention Snap, Crackle and Bop, like those are songs pretty much, apart from Chicken Town, which starts it. So, but we were happy for that. We were happy for that, as that was our approach to it.
Well, Lewis was actually, as I mentioned earlier, we were colleagues perhaps a decade or so ago-ish.
Yeah.
Lewis as well, funnily enough. So how did you get from where we were, which was we were all journalists at a press agency, to librarianship and professional poet?
I really don't know. I've never gone out sort of guerrilla tactics of saying, right, I'm going to be a poet now. Or, I'm not a full-time poet now. I mean, I've got some... status really isn't the word, but I've sort of got some
notoriety.
Maybe not for poetry, but some standing as a poet. I'm the first ever Otley Town poet, which is a great thing, and that suits me because that suits my mindset of towns and people knowing your business and things like that. I really don't know how it's happened. I just always at the core of it, I want to write something memorable, something I'm happy with. I do keep coming back to this. If it's how I process my life and what I perceive. So, if it's true to that and it takes an art form, I think I'm going to be all right. Whether I do get to come back here or anywhere, or whether I just keep writing it. I think about the audience. Like I think about people reading it. But ultimately, it's a selfish exercise, writing poetry. It's all about me.
Otley Town poet, then. How did that happen? Because that's quite an accolade, the first ever Otley Town poet.
Yeah, it's a council scheme, like how the bins get collected, but with a difference. I have free rein to do what I like, but my main role is to engage people in poetry inside the town and outside the town. So, say for instance, tonight people sort of like what I do, then they'll know that I'm from Otley, and that sort of promotes that a bit.
So you're kind of an ambassador for your hometown.
Yeah, with the Ferrero Rocher. But it's really good because I've got certain commitments I have to do, like in a contract. Again, this is something I didn't seek out. I was nominated for it. A group of people nominated for it, and then I got interviewed. And then, But I proposed three ideas, and one of them was when the Tour de Yorkshire was coming through Otley, that we'd make like a little pack that looked like a puncture repair kit. But inside you got sort of all the apparatus you need to write a poem.
Mm.
So something to influence the poem or inspire it, a pencil, paper. And it was all like a nicely gift-wrapped thing. And tourists took it away, you know, like a guy, like people from Suffolk came up and went, ooh, what's going off? And so I was dead proud of that. And recently we've done sort of like a folk music crossover event because they have a folk festival in Otley. And then just very recently, I've sort of hidden... There's a website called geocaching. If people haven't heard of geocaching, it's where you can hide items anywhere. There are certain rules, but anywhere like around a town or in the woods. And you put down the GPS coordinates and you put down little clues about where they are. So I've done little poetry prompts around Otley.
Mm.
There's three of them. And all of those people that collaborate, there's a little register. So you can say, I wrote this bit and my name's blah blah. Then they'll get a dedication when I put the poem together. So it's stuff like that. I've got the freedom to sort of play with the art form a bit.
And also, of course, you've had two collections of poetry published. One is themed on cinema. Were those poems written specifically for that book, or did you just find yourself with a huge collection of poems about the cinema that you thought needed to be compiled?
I wrote it in collaboration with another Leeds poet, James Nash, and it was just an idea that I got from an article that said there were around about 70 picture houses in Leeds, and it just seemed like one of those high concept things where I said to James, like, 70 pages sounds about a poetry collection, so why don't we do a poem for each one? Of course, the projects never end up how they did, because I only wrote, I think, about 11 poems for the collection. James wrote a lot more. But we wrote them specifically for that idea.
One poem per picture house.
Well, we tried to do that, but we sort of did these journeys around Leeds to try and find them. Basically, where we'd pull up in my car, sort of stake out these buildings, and the locals would sort of look out the windows and think, why are there two coppers like watching the street? And but because we visited the same sites, we ended up writing the same poems about the same places. So we never, you know, we didn't reach 70. We probably didn't even reach 20 different cinemas. But the point of the collection is that James is he's 67 next. So he'd been to a lot of them. So he was sort of collecting his memories. This was like a poetic diary for him. But for me, it was like lamenting the idea that, like, all I've got is, well, mainly is the view,
yeah,
or something like that. And these aren't really cinema experiences anymore for me. And if I go to a proper picture house like Cottage Road in Headingley or Hyde Park Picture House, these are cinema moments I remembered, not just because of the film, but because this served a community. And much like a church, people sat down in rows and faced one way for a certain amount of time and then left feeling better about themselves.
Do you have any religious affiliation to any particular film? That seems an appropriate question at this point when you mention religious experience.
Religion and film? I don't know. I mean, religion's just important to me anyway. I don't have faith, but I think Sunday school and all everything in my beginnings is influenced me as an artist. But I refer to the Bible a lot, just because it's a great work of fiction and of imagery and all the subject matter. But in film, I don't know.
Is there a film that you've got a particular affiliation to then? Or not affiliation, that's not the right word. A particular obsession with it? You might be able to describe that obsession as a religious, you know.
Funnily enough, I didn't write about anything like that, because it was sort of a mixture of my experiences and other people's. The one I did write in the book is Beauty and the Beast, just because as I'm getting older, I tend to think about childhood a lot more, just because it was simpler and my chin didn't hit the floor so much. And so Beauty and the Beast is a big one, because we watched that at the cinema, me and my mum, and I do think about it a lot. I really can't watch it because it's just too emotional.
I feel like that about Dumbo. I can't watch that film.
Yeah.
It destroys me. Even if I just catch a couple of minutes of it on the TV or whatever, it's too much.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it, how a childhood moment can actually be remain beautiful all the way through your life, but be really painful as well.
Yeah, I don't mind sharing this, but it might be an uncomfortable thing to hear. But I've got a little scooter, and I was knocked off it in June, and I had a few days off work, and everyone was saying like, don't rush everything because the shock will get you. And I was like, oh, I'm fine. Like I went to the hospital, but nothing serious. And I was on my own in the house, and I don't know why, but I watched the end bit of Batman, the Michael Keaton, Jack Nicholson Batman,
right,
which I saw when it came out on video. When I was 5, I think. So it was a 15 rated film, but I saw it and loved it, and my parents like were okay with it. And the moment that Commissioner Gordon switches on the bat signal, just I was in floods of tears for about 20 minutes, and like all these ideas about childhood and being a decent person and
yeah,
sort of protecting people just all came out. And it's probably a result of the shock, but I think it's the power of the film as well, if you see it as at a young age and when you don't understand what the themes are, and then you see it later on. I'm glad it happened. Like I couldn't, you know, like a long drawn out shock from an accident would have been awful. I'm glad
yeah,
I've got this.
Yeah.
And thanks to Batman.
Well, that sort of takes us back to where we started. So childhood, we were talking about right at the start, we were talking about poetry in schools. Now you do a lot of workshops.
Not a lot. I would like some. To do more. Yeah, I do some workshops, I think it's fair to say.
As somebody who is a practicing poet, then, who engages with young people who are learning about poetry or becoming interested in it or becoming bored by it. So from the other side of the coin almost, or the other side of the line, if you like, how does it look to you when kids engage with poetry?
It's frightening because I think I'll be out of a job most of the times. I did a workshop recently about animals and becoming an animal. And we said that the age range for the group would be 5 to 15. I think that was quite a daring thing.
Yeah.
So, but
there's a huge difference between 5 and 15, isn't there?
But I gave them two tasks, really, and that is to write about becoming an animal. Just write and write and write. And then I explained that there'd be an editing section of the session. And they studiously, you know, a 4.5-year-old who won't be taught how to write, really, in reception, wrote a poem about becoming a tiger. And if he's doing that now and I didn't start till 18, then a 10-year-old wanted to become a wolf, and I said, just write all the things that come to your mind when you think about wolves. And she wrote all these abstract things, like not about fur and claws. She wrote, like, one adjective she used was misunderstood.
Wow.
And I was like, chuffy now, you're 10. And she knew, like, this was poetry, this is a concentrated art form, I've got to get an idea across to you really quickly. And she wrote this amazing poem about the misunderstood wolf.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You'll be crying about that one in 20 years.
I cry all the time, but it's good to have a cry, I think. Yeah. It's good to have a cry.
Matt, we're going to listen to highlights of your set for the second Mouth Magazine Nymphs and Thugs Showcase. Matthew Headley Stoppard, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
Please welcome Matthew Headley Stoppard. Good evening.
Good evening.
I should like to begin with a poem in which the first line is also its title. Don't feel shortchanged by that. I will read poems that have longer titles during my set. And because it's Saturday night, I'll try and keep the subject matter, you know, really light. So this one's about sex workers. A busker leaves the brothel on York Road, circumspect as blackbirds, guitar strapped to his back. Conspicuous and giddy, he walks past the parade of shops, shuttered frontage, newsagent, tattooist. Never had there been such music in him, the ballad of his tingling groin, empty bollocks knocking together like coconuts. The bus stop queue clutching onto day rovers and unsafe jobs knows he has made love to everything that's wrong with this city. Only lice and inflamed skin to show for it. But as far as he's concerned, that was his first girlfriend left trembling on the mattress again, or the wife who left him now re-impregnated. An act that warrants whiskey in the Irish centre and two offerings of Black is the Colour at the mouth of the indoor market. I should like to read you a poem called Most of the Cargo Was Dead Before the Accident. Not an ambulance in sight, the bodies bringing rush hour to a halt. Fin on chevron, gills inhaling petrol fumes, Gurnard staring into cat's eyes. All of which call to my inner junior reporter, shorthand crawling towards my fingers. Refrain from puns such as guttered or large-scale tailbacks. Whiplash Cod Coley had a conspratz delayed a quarter of East Yorkshire's workforce, iced salmon hogging the fast lane. Police cordon off the spilled polystyrene boxes surrounding the jackknife lorry, lobsters twitching inside, net bags of mussels clamping and unclamping on the central reservation. There was no mention of crash or 15 tons of wasted fresh fish in that day's horoscope for Pisces. And it never occurred to the authorities to dredge the motorway to clear up the scene. An unsuccessful feeding of 5,000 to stop the squeals of the approaching rapture of seagulls. I should like to read you a poem called On Hearing the National Coal Mining Museum Was Threatened with Closure. Without coal, when would my father have had his wages docked for the death of a pony called General? He wouldn't have had the best days of his life and become as brave as a robin in hail. Without coal, my childhood would have been spent on a motorway, chasing girls up and down the hard shoulder. I would never have played army or had my first kiss at the back of my neighbour's bunker. Without coal, my pregnant best friend would have sucked on the end of a plutonium rod, not a lump of dusty fuel. Idris would be shivering under Ivor scrap metal and Jones the steam would be on the dole. Without coal, I would never have known a darkness below us, hot as Hades and blacker than mud. Without it, my world would be empty and cold, and my heart would not pump red blood. Yeah. I should like to read you a poem called Congregation of Thugs, and this is for all the scallywags who get away with it. And it makes you want to join in. And this is for Dangerous Dean, who fixed my dad's aerial. More and more we find ourselves denim clad, with arteries of crooked church lead cluttering the flat. And you can't move for bicycles without front wheels, empty cans of special brew, all to be traded at the scrapyard. Him over there tells an anecdote like an umbrella opening up your arse about his beginnings as a collection plate thief and lip-sticking dirty limericks on dressing room mirrors belonging to magician's assistants at Batley Variety Club. Don't believe any of it. We have to burglarise truths here. But I don't mind a good lie being broken into. Sin shines on gold teeth when saying, "This is not an electronic tag. This is an anklet for you, my love." Muscle is hard to come by, but we have this wiry one who can bore through any blockade. I can count on him to sing, "If I had a hammer, I'd cave your fucking head in and bring a shotgun to hook a duck." Where do I fit in? I possess the plans, the visions. I can see your bones knit following a fracture sustained from falling from a drainpipe. These men listen when I stand above them like a stained glass saint, ready to outline our next move. I'm getting older. I guess everyone's getting older. We have to accept that fact. So I dwell more on my childhood now. Since turning 30, it seems my chin and genitals have entered a race to see who can hit the floor first. So, as we're so close to the coast, I should like to read you a poem called Glass Bottom Boat. Neither seasickness nor curfew swayed me, worming through the rectangled crowd, their faces scaly and Skegness blue. Rogue elbows and wrecking ball breasts knocked any question out of me reaching the front, where I swear I saw a mermaid nursing her lover's skeleton, still wearing flippers, goggles and snorkel. No one stopped me vaulting the barrier, but when I started stamping on the glass platform, adult hands hooked my armpits, reeling me in, kicking and flailing before I broke through. Afterwards, curled up in a pile of coats, my mother peeled back my ears to reveal the gills I had drawn there with her eyeliner pencil. So I grew up in Clay Cross in Derbyshire, and I found a picture at my mother's house which sort of summed up my childhood in this place, and it's a picture of me in a thickly knitted jumper, bright blonde hair, this is when I'm about 5 years old, not like last week, reaching up to what looks like a balloon. But if you look closer at the picture, it's actually an inflated condom. And for me, that sort of sums up growing, you know, living in an ex-mining town. So again, this poem, the first line is also its title. And you think about it, I'm doing this for you. This is premium stuff. I mean, I'm saving you time. You can go and get an extra drink and stuff. When I sprouted legs, Sunday school doors swung open. Honest as hymns, I was first out into fields, necklaced with pylons, still reciting the Lord's Prayer, brushing biscuit crumbs from my ladybird waistcoat. Within hiccups, the pond side appeared, and I nestled in the ribbit and bulrushes, every inch of my skin ticklish. Dazzled by bright browns, my eyes turned into tadpoles fixated on tectonic lily pads, and I gave confession to the priestly mallard. Heron-headed drinkers, grey hair fine and side-parted, spoke psalmfully with their these and thines, remarking on the toy hearse I pushed under snooker tables and dartboards, and the time a mix of shandy and sherbet foamed me rabid. Swept up in sugar and fizz, wallpaper surrounded me, reassured by tumble-dried clothes, the hum of Hoover's lulled, and someone put a lampshade on my son. Digits become fingers, calcium spots orbiting the nails quick fade. I have signed my tenancy with manhood, but I'll rib it before I croak. The turtleneck was not a good choice. I'm getting quite warm.
Oh, underneath, Matthew.
It's not that kind of show, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. I'd like to think up... All right. Don't start chucking fivers at me and stuff like that. I'd like to think I've grown up a little bit now. I've got a wife and kids. And this is a real honest account of what I think sometimes in our family outings. So we visit several places across the North and the Midlands. The poem's called Bruises Beneath Feathers. Black clouds over Hull cast moving shadows like a stranger walking past your bedroom door. Drying rain burns skin near the Spurn lightship. We pull back the children from the harbour rails. I let down the umbrella and use it to skewer a seagull. Every alarm clock hour after midnight was seen before carrying the children across the field behind Rothwell's jawbones. No shade or horses to distract and help piece together broken sleep. You call it straw. I call it scarecrow guts. While holding a rook in a headlock. Guarding the picnic blanket proves too difficult amidst quacking and the rumble of Matlock motorboats. I'm pushing the children towards the paddling pool. A swan waddles up. I look at you as my hands wring its slender neck. But a blown kiss lets me know our eldest is the same age as me when I fell in the water here. A disturbance of mallards drew attention to my drowning. Two tourists came to the rescue. pond in my lungs. I let the bird go, plucking a feather for you. Another light topic, this one's about death. The poem's called Burial with Trowel. Dawn reflecting off double-decker windows lit the scene of a perfect death. Neck crushed and mouth agape, almost seizing the bait. Amazed such barbaric apparatus can still be bought. Imagine calling at the corner shop for a guillotine, say. He could have been more humane, but anything that makes a man leap upon a chair like an hysterical cartoon cat owner in slippers and sagging socks brings out the murderer in him. He could neither dump its body in the wheelie bin nor reveal to his wife and children the regret he felt. Instead, like some undertaker in a dressing gown, buried it 6 inches deep behind the shed, muttering a prayer, wondering when he would kill again. So I lived in a part of Leeds and I saw something there and it sort of gave me this fit of optimism. The poem's called Upon Finding Abandoned Crutches in East End Park. Imaginatively titled. Stranger items have been tripped over in the street, but one parched afternoon when blood was soup collapsed across the curb, those traditional sticks complete with rubber curls that sit under armpits gave me such hope. Approaching the elbow of the hedge. Turning left could be a Pentecostal preacher palming a cripple's forehead, or even Jesus himself after a sermon on Ivy Mount, uttering to the leper, "Be clean, be clean." Tiny Tim would be catching coins tossed from Velux windows and blessing everyone in the working men's club. There was a clacking of oak on concrete, seeing a paraplegic dancing on wooden legs, and a Long John silvered Leodian cutlassing schoolchildren into the air and colder navigation. No miracles or adventure round in the corner, though. Just dusk and litter trickling towards my house, where I watch too much television. This will be my last poem. I know some of you said thank God out there. And it's the title poem from my book, my first book. And it may seem sort of melodramatic, and I do give this little speech before it, but I think it's really important because I found with all the trappings of having a family or being with your family, your mum, your dad, your son, your daughter, whoever, all the trappings of that, so sort of like asking for time off work to go to a funeral, or interviewing childminders, all that's bollocks. Like, the important part of being in your family is being together as much as possible, because we're all animals after all. So you should be in your warren, or in your sty if you're really messy, or in your set if you've got a bad cough. So the poem's called I'm Waving to a Family Behind Glass, and thank you for listening. And look, thank you. And looking in my direction, feeling awkward. Billiard balls are easier to swallow than the dread clogging my throat when my wife lifted our son to the front door window to say goodbye. Not quite pressing a hand against carriage glass on a train to Belsen, or blowing kisses inside a space helmet before boarding the Challenger shuttle. Nevertheless, I felt my chest tighten at the sight, like clay setting in a kiln. The imagined farewell at the end of visiting hours at Ramby Prison and the halfway house in Cathy Come Home tugged at my bottom lip. Even though I would return from work in less than what is deemed a good night's sleep, a day closer to retirement. Thank you very much, everyone.
www.themouthmagazine.com